Reset the Podcast is brought to you in association with Liars, the non-alcoholic spirits brand that gives everyone the freedom to drink their way.
Hello everyone, my name is Suki Thompson. Welcome to Reset the Podcast, a place for you to get some inspiration and advice to help you live a more fulfilling work life. I do hope that your journey to feel more connected, more inspired, just a bit more energized starts here. Take a moment now with me to reset. Paul Pomeroy is the CEO of McDonald's UK and Ireland. But here in this Reset podcast, work isn't on the agenda. Instead, Paul talks to me about the kind of life experiences that have contributed to the leader he is today. Experiences with his dad, his family, and his friends have all shaped his view that authenticity is the key to great leadership and culture. In this personally revealing, brave, and open conversation, we discuss how bringing his whole self to work is perhaps something that defines Paul's professional life. Finally, and perhaps most tellingly, he explains why it's so important for his colleagues to feel that sometimes it's okay to not be okay. Hi, Paul. How are you today?
Yeah, hi, Suki. Good. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm really looking forward to this conversation because you and I normally... We've known each other for a long time. I've worked with across my other business, Oyster Catchers, with McDonald's for 10 years. And you and I meet two or three times a year in a business context, and we've interviewed and talked to each other. But we always talk about business. We talk a little bit about leadership and culture, but it's always in the context of McDonald's and maybe marketing or the fact that you're 100% chicken breast and... Yeah. What whole cut British Irish beef, and what you've been trying to do during the pandemic. We've never talked about you really as a human being and the impact that that's had. And one of the things that I did with my Let's Reset book was talk to a lot of leaders about what really was behind their leadership and their motivation and how that impacted themselves. And at the time I asked you if you wanted to be part of the book, and you didn't think it was probably quite right then.
Yeah, it wasn't quite the right time for me in the journey that I was on, I suppose, as a leader. But yeah, obviously now, a few years on, in a different place.
So that's what we're going to talk about today. So, Paul, let's start with you as a child. Mm-hmm. What was your childhood like?
So I think, like most, I have to divulge my age now, won't I? But I'm 47, so I grew up in the 70s. So I was born in 1973. And it's fascinating at the moment, you kind of reflect on your life as a child versus what we're going through in the awful crisis and the restrictions that we have on my two boys, which we'll come on to talk about. But I think, my childhood was probably similar to what we're going through at the moment. You lived quite a simple life, relative, in terms of travel. My parents were both hardworking. My dad was a sales rep for a frozen food company, very good at that. And my mum used to work for the Bank of England before she had children. We lived in a kind of a new village in South London, sort of North Kent, where I knew all my friends personally. I still got them as mates today, 40 odd years on. We grew up in the same cul-de-sac. We played football together. But my life was very... probably within a sort of 5 to 6 mile radius, to be honest, Suki. So I didn't travel much further than my grandparents' house in the next sort of town over. We went on one holiday a year, which is a summer holiday, and that was the only holiday we went on. School holidays were spent in the woods, in the fields, going fishing, playing football, out on my bikes. And then obviously, I think you and I spoke before about my dad. My dad was, really into sport and activities and stuff, but he was a bit of a Jekyll and Hyde character and could lose his temper very quickly, often for no reason, which obviously created tension in the family unit. He'd lose my temper with me, he'd lose my temper with my mum, and he never knew what could come through the door. There were many positives from my dad in terms of what he gave me and the support and the sport and the and the grounding in life. And he was very driven as a human being. But obviously the bit that affects me as I got older was the uncertainty of what might come through the door in the evening. So that was the bit that obviously affected me growing up more, was that bit of kind of not knowing quite what could walk through the door. And we can come on to talk about some of that in a little while. But overall, I'd say that I loved school. I enjoyed school. I wasn't the model student. I got distracted easily. I found school fairly easy. I didn't struggle to grasp things. So I got bored quickly. I think, I used to be quite annoying as a student. I remember when I was 11, I just passed 11 plus, and my deputy head teacher, Mrs. Lloyd, bless her, who's passed away now, gave me one hell of a kick up the bottom in front of my parents, which was that it was a shame that I passed 11 plus, because it was a wasted place for someone that would work hard. And unbeknown to me, that was my first probably big motivational moment, where someone, gave me a bit of a motivational speech, really. And from that day onwards, I worked probably a bit harder. But Mrs. Lloyd kind of, made me sort of sit up and take notice, to be honest. But no, overall, when I look back on my childhood, it was all about friends. And I'm very loyal as a person, very honest, very committed to my friends and my family. My sister and I are very close, as you know. She's 4.5 years younger than me, that she reminds me a lot. But her and I are very close. And one of the hardest things about the crisis and the pandemic is I've only seen my sister twice in a year's period, and she only lives in South London. And I've only seen my mates once in a year. Normally we see each other every month for a curry or a beer or whatever. And that's important as a leader, because obviously that keeps me grounded. Going back to Bromley or Petswood to have a beer. When I walk in the pub, I'm not Paul Pomeroy, the CEO of McDonald's. I'm Paul, who they've known for 40 years, and I miss them. They do keep me grounded. They've all got different jobs, different backgrounds, but we've known each other a long time.
Gosh, there's so much there, isn't it? And it's fascinating. Before we come on to your dad and the impact of that, and now you as a dad, as a father yourself, I'm fascinated about your friends, because my observation is lots of leaders that I know have friends that they've had from, absolutely childhood. They're very loyal to them. They're around. I can think of really quite a lot of them. And I wonder whether there's, that sense of what you said is you're not the chief executive McDonald's with you with them, and they'll give you a bit of a ribbing for whatever you are as a person, other than treating you differently, and whether there's also just that kind of sense of people who are leaders often have very strong need for those around them to be loyal and to be loyal themselves.
One of the things that I'm very passionate about is, kind of integrity and trust and values. And obviously, my friends, there's the utmost trust and integrity. So there's 15 or 16 of us that have known each other since the age of, some of us, I was in pram in nappies with them. I mean, Greg, Simon and Neil, specifically, we were born, within a year of each other, and spent our lives, and, I can trust them with anything, and they've known me throughout. The latest addition to the group was when I was about 15. So, it's been 30 years for all of us. And we kind of went to different schools, come back together, and the group just grew. But I think surrounding yourself with people that share the same values and integrity, I think my mum's always taught me to treat other people how you'd want to be treated yourself. And I think all of my mates share those values. We work hard. Some of us have been more successful professionally than others. But we've always worked hard. We've enjoyed good times together. We're not a group of people that are into kind of the financial part of working. It doesn't matter whether it's one of my mates who's an electrician or a scaffolder, or me as the CEO of McDonald's. We all buy a beer. It's not about your wealth or your income. It's just about who you are as a person. So I suppose we share those common set of values. And obviously, a lot is talked about, certainly McDonald's, but business generally, about values and integrity. And I think that is something, as a leader, you want to surround yourself with good people. And it's the same here for my team. You need bright people on your team, but they need to be people that fit within your ethos of what's right and wrong. And getting up every morning trying to do the right thing by people is something I pride myself on. And do you get it right every day, Suki? As you don't. You have bad days. The boys can irritate me. You can have a moment that bursts your bubble. Someone cuts you up on the on the way to work, you have a moment. You don't get it right all the time, but you apologize for those moments. And I think my friends, I don't need to say anything. They know that if I have a moment, they know me well enough that it's a moment and you don't mean anything by it. Of course, I apologize, but they forgive you very quickly.
Yeah, well, that's the nice thing about having long-term friends.
There's also, the other thing for me is it's a release, Suki, as well. I mean, as a leader, and you know this yourself, you know, you've been very successful in your career. You want to be as authentic as possible. Of course you do. But the moment I step out the car in the morning in the car park downstairs, I am then the boss. And that creates a different pressure on you. Everyone watches everything you do. You and I have talked about this. You know, it's a weird feeling. It's one of the weirdest feelings you have when you first take the job, is that suddenly you go from being in the background as a CFO to being looked at permanently, and you feel like you live your life through a microscope when you're in work, both internally and externally. You know, whatever you say gets scrutinized, whatever actions you do get scrutinized, how you put your coat on as you get out of the car, people assume you're in a good mood or a bad mood. Whereas when you need people around you that you can just be yourself. And I think if you can do that, it's a release. It is a release, because you don't want to be on show permanently. And it's the same for Nat, myself and the boys. It's, you know, as you know, I try not to give the boys any special treatment. It's difficult, but you want to be just a normal dad that enjoys normal things like bike rides and walks and, you know, letting them climb trees and, you know, fall over and hurt themselves in the same way as I did. And you just want that normality, I think.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? When I first got my place down in Cornwall, just after that, I was writing my book. And so it wasn't until I was there for lockdown that a number of my neighbours, they were chatting away and they said, oh, of course, you know, Suki's an author. And I looked at them and I'm like, sorry? They said, well, because you write those books, don't you? And it was so weird, because completely it was not what I identify as at all. But, you know, it is fascinating. And, you know, lots of those people I've grown up with. And same thing. If you're on the beach and surfing in the sea, if you can surf, you can surf. If you can't, you can't. But they don't care where you come from.
No, exactly. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about your dad. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? So, you know, I didn't grow up with my dad because my parents were divorced when I was five. But, you know, over the years I've seen, and I see it now occasionally with some of my friends. There's a lady called Sandra Hawley who wrote a brilliant book called Power and Control, Why Charming Men Can Make Dangerous Lovers. Mm. And the book was about, you know, on the outside, and it was particularly about men, and I'm not saying this isn't the same for women, because women are different, but there are lots of men who on the outside look amazing, they're charming, they're lovely. And, you know, I think if people are all bad or all horrible, it's quite easy to go, they're a horrible person. So what we see is men, perhaps like your dad, who actually have so many good bits, and you've got so much that's been great from them. But that moment, I guess, for you, not knowing what he was going to be like, or that moment of when he lost his temper, that must be really hard. How did you feel? Can you remember? Can you go back into that time and remember how you felt as a child?
Yeah, so, I mean, for me, you know, you know, I talked about it before, you know, I love my mum and I love my dad, and obviously for the good bits and the bad bits, but it's... the thing that happens is that you, when there is uncertainty in a child's life, obviously that creates a conditioning to how you then behave in later life. And I think one of the things that I talk very openly about here is that everyone's upbringing creates part of them. You know, whether it's your mum and dad when you're younger, which school you went to, what your teachers were like, every influence on you as you grow up, the mentors you have around you, everyone influences your life either positively or negatively, and or both at the same time, as we've talked about. And I think what happens is that, you know, you get a fear. I mean, fear is the word that you have as a youngster. You have a fear of making a mistake, which obviously in leadership is bizarre, because I don't ever have a fear of making mistakes in work. So it's very much a separation for me. And one of the things that my dad did give me was an incredible drive and determination, because he was very competitive and very driven as a person, which meant for me to want to please him, I would have a drive and determination to do that. And so there's a lot of good stuff that came out, but obviously some of the negative stuff that comes out is that fear of making a mistake. And certainly it didn't really manifest itself in my later life, not that I noticed, I'm sure my psychologist would say that's not the case, of course. But she would say that, of course, it manifests itself through my obsession with gym and commitment to all the stuff that I'm driven by is obviously part of what's gone on. But it really manifested itself as William, my oldest son, hit the age of about sort of 3.5, 4. And obviously Natalie and I, my wife, talked about the fact that, you know, I need to be able to, you know, tell the boys off. I mean, Oliver and William now, you know, 9 and 6, and I need to be able to tell the boys off and not feel guilty. And obviously what happened for me was I have got, you know, like any person, you have a, there's a tolerance of, and you have a temper. I can end up shouting. And what ends up happening is if I do shout at the boys, I feel guilty. And then obviously if I don't talk about it in work and I come to work, then, you know, that's on my mind. So, you know, I needed to get a way of dealing with the fact that firstly, to try not to lose my temper, anyone, you don't want to lose your temper because it's not a good place. But secondly, when you do need to hold a line, to hold a line and not feel guilty, and the anxiety that comes with that, and you do feel guilty, and you overthink things, your inner voice at night, you lie there in bed. And certainly, bizarrely, you know, I can make massive decisions for McDonald's and not stress about it. But I can make one small decision for the boys either way and then worry about it. Have you done the right thing? Because there's no replays with child. And I suppose because you want to be the perfect parent, which doesn't exist. It's impossible to be the perfect parent. But you want to try and be perfect. And with the stresses of life, as everyone has stresses in life, it's impossible. And Shani, my psychologist, taught me fairly early on in our relationship that, you know, good enough is good enough, because I am a perfectionist, as you know. And trying to do 110% on everything was just not possible. So her statement of, look, good enough is good enough. You're going to make mistakes. And the other, she's got me reading loads of books and watching podcasts, but there's one about, you know, imperfection, which just the title alone freaked me out. To read a book about being imperfect was quite stressful to start off with. But no, it's true, because obviously you want to not make mistakes. And I think that's part of the challenge for me, is that, you know, I hate losing. I don't mind losing if we've given it a good go, but I hate losing if we've not given it a good go. That's part of my DNA, and everyone knows that here. But I also, you know, I don't mind making mistakes in work, but they've got to be for the right reasons. And I suppose as you've gone through that journey, Natalie and I had a really good conversation about, look, you know, I tried when I was younger to see a psychiatrist and a psychologist. I didn't connect. I don't think I was mature enough. I was 27 at the time. And I just didn't connect with the psychologist that I got paired with through work, through the private healthcare, which we can come on to talk about how supportive McDonald's are. But this time around, I connected, and maybe it's because I'm older, more committed, a bit more mature about it. And also, I think the world's in a different place. If you think about when I was 27, 20 years ago, no one talked about seeing a psychologist, or it was a taboo subject. Whereas now I feel really comfortable as a leader to say, look, you know, I've got 2 dodgy knees from football. I get help. You know, I need help being a dad. You know, I read books and I see a psychologist. And I think I'm really open about the fact that that's who I am. And it's not a problem with it. I'm really open about that. And it helps. It's amazing how it's then really helped McDonald's, and how it's really shone a light on. We've had some amazing stories for our wellbeing festival we've just held. And I think it's helped people get through COVID, because I'm at the top. I'm authentic about the fact that there's moments when with homeschooling, it's been tough with not seeing my mum, not seeing my sister. It's been, I mean, I'm very honest about that. And as you know, one famous podcast that I was doing with work to 700 people, when my youngest wanted to go to the toilet and shared that he wanted to go to poo with everyone. And it's fine. It's life.
I know. So, I mean, I think it's so interesting, isn't it, that, you know, this desire to be perfect is fascinating. And again, it's something we see a lot. And it's funny, isn't it, because failure is the way that we kind of learn stuff, and particularly when we're young, particularly and in business all the time. And it's interesting that you have this. You know, because I think you're very open and you're very inclusive, and you're really keen on people being challenged and challenging. And I wonder whether, you know, your boys will be able to grow up and then also work in environments where failure is not seen as something bad, that failure is actually seen as a route and a way to to be better and to learn and to grow and to innovate. Do you think you're on that journey to be able to change your kind of what's in your DNA and what you've learned during your
life? So in terms of it's fascinating. So I'm driven. If I do anything, I do it to 110%. It's probably my biggest. And I struggle to relax. And I think that goes back to my childhood, because obviously I learned that if I kept busy, I kept out of the way. But part of that is personality. So part of it is nature, obviously, and part of it is nurture. That I am my mum is a very, energetic, driven person as well. But if I do anything, I do it really well. So if I play golf, I practice. If I do football, I practice. And as you know, I've got spreadsheets that track the number of attendances at the gym, going back to 2007, which isn't normal. But one of the things that I do with the boys, which is different, is that, we talk about stuff very openly, at the right level, obviously, but they can poke fun at dad as well. And I encourage them to give me feedback when I'm being annoying, being irritating. It's funny how, mentally, if we go for a walk, I mentally log how long it takes us, and but I don't share that with the boys, and last time how many steps and stuff like that. It's just the way I am, but I try not to share that with the boys, obviously. The other thing that I encourage them a lot to do is to try loads of new things, and they do lots of different things, and obviously you want them to try as many things as possible. And I think one of the fascinating many moments as a dad, but watching the boys learn to ride a bike, there's no way you can learn to ride a bike without failure and a few cuts and bruises. So that was a fascinating, firstly, you nearly break your back running along behind them anyway. But there's no way you can learn to ride a bike without falling off. It's impossible. So I think, again, there's been many moments where, they're a real leveler in terms of, and then I read books. I do read. I mean, one of the best books I've read about being a dad is a book called Raising Boys by a psychologist called Steve Bidulph. And it helps you understand the emotional side of what boys go through. Puberty starts a lot younger than society used to realize, which is great that we know that now, but it starts at sort of 8, not 11, when their physical changes start. But that's helped me with William, the oldest one, who's already going through the kind of, trying to manage his hormones and his, how he feels and stuff. And so just understanding how, boys need a different input to girls. And I know you've got a boy and a girl, whereas I've got two boys, but they all need different, different inputs, and they're not all the same either. So Oliver, my youngest, is very different to William, my oldest. But there's very, a lot of common bits as well. But, I think it's fascinating as a parent. One of the things I'm trying to break down as well here is that when you go and ride a bike, you learn. When you go and drive a car, you learn. When you go and do anything, you learn. Whereas, the scary thing as a dad is nine years ago, William came along, and Natalie and I leave the hospital with this little bundle of joy that you've got. There's no manual.
And I think you can't change them, can you? I mean, I think in work, if somebody underperforms or they don't do it quite how you want it to do, you kind of can get rid of them or move them on or do whatever. And I think the biggest challenge that I had with Sam and Jazz was that Jazz sort of behaved like a girl I could understand. Because she was a bit similar to me, a bit similar to my sister and other. Sam was so different. He was a bit more like my dad, my brother probably. But I didn't expect to have a boy that really didn't like sport or actually didn't like going to school or wasn't going to run through education in the way that I had seen other people do. And I find that really hard and really challenging. And taking time out from work at the time to go, I know when you say you just need to kick him and up the arse metaphorically and get him into school, you don't quite understand. Sam would not go to school. And, he turned up with me at McDonald's meetings occasionally.
Yeah.
That was really hard. Yeah. And I think I just hadn't appreciated that might just happen.
Well, the other bit for me, Suki, is on that front is that part of the reason I'm open about, we all need help from time to time in everything in life, is that people think that because you're the CEO of McDonald's, your whole life's perfect.
Yeah.
And you find everything easy because you've made it to the top of the business in the UK. And you know this, you've been very successful. You've run your own business. And there's always this stigma around what's expected of you surely Suki can't have a problem with being a parent. She's a successful entrepreneur and she's made it in life. And of course, it's not the reality, as you and I have talked about before, is that, you know, my boys don't care that I'm the CEO of McDonald's. They couldn't care less. I'm dad. And the same for you is that, you know, you can do all you can, but you can't fix everything for them. That's the hardest thing, I think, is when you can see problems coming, you've got to allow them to make their own mistakes, but you know that you could probably fix the problems before they arise, but you can't. You've got to just let them go through it. It's like when they're riding their bike fast around the corner, you know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I know.
But the only way they're going to learn is by taking a few chunks off their knee. You want to limit that, but they've got to feel the same sort of pain as you did as a child to understand, because otherwise they'll never learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the other thing I'm quite interested in is that you've got, Nat's an amazing woman and a brilliant businesswoman in her own right.
Yeah.
You've got Shani, your therapist, psychologist.
Yeah.
You have a number of very...
Yeah, and Annette's my mentor as well, my external coach. Yeah.
Yeah. What is it about, have you specifically chosen sort of quite strong women to be around you? Do you recognise that?
Yeah, do you know what? It's funny. I was talking to Annette about it. We always do a year end. I try to set a target each year of being, you know, 20% better each year. Obviously, I set 20% because you know you're never going to get to 20, but maybe 10. And I reflected on it that I do. You know, I've got yourself that I pull on a lot in terms of being a good friend and coach and mentor as well. And I, you know, and obviously, you know, my old boss Jill that we both know as well. And there's. I don't deliberately do it, but obviously there's something in my childhood that is there, because, you know, my mum was a big role model. My nan on my mum's side as well was a big role model to me. Clearly, it was a deliberate choice, though, for Annette, because at that time we had very few women, as you know, at a senior level in McDonald's. So we just lost a number of women when I took over. Obviously, we'd lost Jill as well. I deliberately felt that I needed a role model and a mentor that was a woman, because to give me balance in the business sense. But yeah, there's definitely something in my nurturing and upbringing that allows me to gravitate to have women influence me as a leader, which I think is refreshing, and really, in terms of, you know, that may not have always been the case in leadership, that men would be open about that. Mm-hmm. And I you know, McDonald's serves 4 million people a day in the UK. Over 50%, around 50% are women. In our workforce, we've got 50%, you know, male, female split now. I'm really proud of that. And we've got 40% of my leadership team. So I'm really proud of the progress we've made on gender diversity. But for me to understand, I think I need to be influenced by women. And I think a lot more leaders now are being open to that. I think, you know, there's a generation of leaders coming through that are more open to that. I think that the times have changed a lot, and I think it's refreshing that we can talk about the fact that there should be a healthy mix and a healthy balance. But but I do, when I reflect on it, there's a lot of women that influence me, and it's positive, to be honest, Suki. It's really positive. I know we joke about it sometimes, but I'm positive about it. And don't forget, my wife at home, as you say, she's quieter than me in terms of her outgoing, but she's a really strong woman, and she definitely lets me know when I'm overstepping the mark, both either, you know, and obviously in a business sense, her and I can have a good chat about stuff, because she's a smart lady, you say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, you just touched on a little bit around diversity and inclusion has been something you have focused on at McDonald's. Yeah. And then you're part of, I call it Whittle, but it's that kind of Taya's business that looks at diversity, particularly across your sector. And you've done quite a lot at McDonald's for that, but you've also have looked at the well-being of staff, certainly before lockdown and during last year. What kind of things have you been doing with your staff?
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, one of the things that I've always talked openly about, I've been here, you know, 24 years. I mean, it's most of my adult life has been at McDonald's. I started as a trainee accountant externally at Smith & Williamson, and I qualified in 1996. I joined McDonald's, as you know, at the end of 96, thinking I'd do a few years. And here I still am, and 24 years on. But I think one of the things I've always prided myself on, Suki, is that firstly, you need to switch off. Now, everyone switches off in a different way. And I know we joked at the start about me being, you know, maybe driven, but I have to switch off. And the way I switch off is, you know, exercise, watching sport, playing sport, less playing sport as I've got older, but still exercise. my exercise routines have changed. I do a lot more Pilates and yoga now, as you know, than I used to do. Having the ability to switch off is important. I've always done that. I've always been very fortunate. I'm quite a strong character that I can switch off though, and I don't feel the peer pressure to stay on all the time. And one of the things I vowed when I took over, you know, 5 and a bit years ago, or 6 years ago now, was to make sure that I was open about the fact that I don't believe in 24/7, you know, work. You can't work 24/7. Anyone that works 18 hours a day, you know, you're not going to be productive. You're going to burn out. You're also going to affect your team a lot if you're always on. So some of the things we've done over the last year or so that we were working on before, but we've got, you know, obviously accelerated because of COVID, is that, you know, we've done Wellbeing Festival, where we've actually openly had a whole day where we closed the office. Yeah. And did a festival of wellbeing. And, you know, we had Ruby Wax join that, which was fascinating conversation. She was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. As a pioneer of someone that's talked about wellbeing and her own journey, she was fantastic. She had some brilliant stories on her life as well. Also for me, for what we've done around that, though, is the festival was a kind of another moment in time where we looked at what's the kind of culture that we want to create. And so we've done some practical things off the back of that. So we don't email each other between 7 at night and 7 in the morning. Meetings now don't start until 9, but finish by 4. And that allows people to switch off and catch up. But also for working parents, obviously at the moment it's tough with homeschooling and getting kids to and from school without support, because you can't have your support bubble. So again, it allows people to not feel guilty. There's a lot of guilt that can creep into the workplace. We've then had, we got doctors on hand. So we have a hotline for people that feel that they need to speak to a doctor. We also have psychologists on hand that can talk to our people across the whole of our networks. 130,000 people have access to people from a psychology point of view, from a financial planning point of view, and from a doctor. And as you know, here in head office, we have a couple of doctors that come in 2 or 3 times a week. Obviously not at the moment because we're in lockdown, but they come in and they can do some routine checks. Because the thing that happens in life as well is that everyone's always too busy to get themselves checked. We have a great private healthcare plan for our people, but if you don't get referred, then there's no point having it. So allowing people to go to a private medical room here in the office and just get checked and then get referred means that there's no excuse for not getting yourself, you know, sorted out. Because I think too often people excuse away that they haven't got time to go to a doctor or to see a psychologist, or, you know, so trying to break down some of that has been, you know, really important. And then some of the other bits is just me leading by example. As you know, I'm a noisy leaver. I deliberately park my car at the front of the office so people can see me leaving at 5.
I love that expression. You're a noisy leaver. And
yeah, I'm deliberately so. I make a big racket.
You're good at saying that. The other one I love is that you sometimes will take your boys to school and you'll tell people you're not going to start early because you take your boys to school. And I think it's a fantastic, not just symbol, but they can see you actually do that.
And I'm really proud of Nat's career. So we're, you know, Nat's been, as you know, very successful. She's now, you know, Chief Marketing Officer for MacArthur Glen. She's worked here at McDonald's and then at Whitbread. You know, for us to both be successful, we need to share the workload of the home life. And we found a way that works for us too. But I would deliberately, if I can, I'll be the one that cancels a meeting, because there still can be a stigma for a working woman that if it's always the woman that cancels the meeting. And I say this a lot here, that for every working man is a working woman generally. I know that can be challenged and stereotypical and all that. If people are divorced, I know that. But people need to share. So men need to be flexible as well as women. For that to work, you've got to be flexible. And I'll try as often as possible to be the one that, you know, I'll take William for all his checkups and Oliver and, you know, anything they need to do, I'll be the one that cancels, because I think it's important. It's also important here at McDonald's, but it's also important for Nat when she's at work that she doesn't feel like it's always going to have to be her that cancels her meetings.
And I think that's really interesting, because it's a brilliant thing to do. But you could argue that in some ways it's not easier for you to do it than other people, but you are in control. You are the boss. So if you say, I don't know, I'm going to take William and Oliver to school, there's no one who can really go, boy, you better not do that. I think that it's quite difficult in the middle of an organisation to be, I mean, it's bad enough being a woman, and we've seen that COVID has massively impacted women because they have taken, we've seen this, the brunt of particularly COVID parent and children looking after them, and maybe elderly parents as well. But how do you do that, and how do you enable that to happen across the organisation?
Yeah, and it's right, it is easier for me. There's no getting away from that. There's many reasons it's easier for me, whether it's financial, whether it's, you know, where you are in life in terms of the leader. But the reason I talk about it, Suki, is I want to make it easier for other people. And that's the important part, is that if I've grown up in business where, you know, no one ever talked about having a mentor. No one ever talked about having a coach. No one ever talked about having people like you that I pull on. As you know, I'm not a marketeer. You've told me that many times. But there are times when I need an external perspective from a marketing point of view just to help me. And I'll come to you on that. I think in days gone by, no one would be open about saying that, you know, you pulled on people for help. And I think it's important that you've got to share your vulnerabilities, you know, be proud about what you are good at, but also be honest about what you're not good at. You know, I'm not a marketeer. I need people to help me on that stuff. Otherwise, you know, if I get involved in marketing, it's dangerous. But it's the same with how do you set that culture where people can be open and honest about, here's where I am. If I'm not honest about the fact that, you know, homeschooling can be tough. You know, William calls me a dinosaur because, you know, he thinks I come from the dark ages, the way I do my long multiplication and stuff. But if you're not open about it, then you're not setting a culture where people can be open as well. And it's been fascinating this year in 2020, obviously we're in 2021 now, but in 2020 where we've had people come forward on our wellbeing days and tell their own stories to the office. So suddenly me telling my story about the challenges of being a good dad or work-life balance or the way Nat and I run our family situation, me telling those stories internally has given permission from people all across the organization to tell their own stories. The other thing I do as well is, as you know, I get reverse mentored. So I have a number of people from different backgrounds that meet with me. We have the Diversity Club that, you know, is a group of young people that have come together naturally, and they meet with me to challenge me and to give me feedback. I've got Pauline, you know, who's the most senior, you know, vice president at Virgin, who's a black lady who mentors me around, you know, ethnicity and the journey we're going on there. So being honest about the fact I haven't got all the answers, Suki, is important, but creating a culture where people feel comfortable that they can talk about their challenges in life. And everyone, I think the nice thing is for me is I've grown up and worked hard, come from a kind of fairly working class background. My friends are, as I said before, you know, carpenters, electricians, scaffolders, bankers, city traders. We've all, you know, done different careers, but I understand the stresses of, you know, different backgrounds. And I think that's important to you know, I played football in the 80s where I saw racism. You know, some of my best friends that I played football with that were, you know, black people, I've seen racism firsthand, and it's not very pleasant. And one of the things I vowed taking this job is that I would make, you know, an environment where everyone felt comfortable. Do we get it right every day? No. Are we better today than we were 6 years ago? Yes. Do we still have a journey to go on? Definitely. But, you know, if you want to treat people how you want to be treated yourself, then bullying, racism, sexism, whatever you want to talk about has no part in my culture. And, you know, we can't get it right every day. It's impossible. That's not human nature. But going on a journey where you keep improving and keep being honest about it is important. And, you know, I think too often people don't talk about that side of stuff as well. You've got to, the culture we have today is not going to be good enough for tomorrow. The culture we had 10 years ago isn't good enough for today. So we've got to keep moving forward. Let's not dwell in the past about why it was like it was. We just got to acknowledge it wasn't good enough and move on and try and fix it. And the nice thing is for me is that I've got the ability to fix it, and I'm proud of that. And I don't want to look back on my career and didn't fix the bits I could have fixed.
Well, and I think, and yeah, that's absolutely right. And it's so refreshing to hear that. And I know that because we've had this and been on this journey together. And I think so often it's shame and fear that stops people speaking out. You know, if there are, and as I've said to this before, there are a number of people that I know the kind of stories and the things that they've gone through and going through that make them the leaders that they are, but through shame and fear will not talk about it. And therefore, I don't think you can have authentic cultures. You can't have environments where you're genuinely going to be able to have great places that people can work, that they feel that they can bring their whole selves to work, because they don't have, because they have that shame and fear themselves. And that's, it's not, they can't see it in the leaders either.
Yeah. And I think the other big thing that I try to do is empower my people. And, you know, I don't know what it feels like to be a black person. I can't. It's not possible for me to be able to say that I can. I can't walk in their shoes. That's impossible. I don't know what it's like to be a working mum like you do, having gone through what you went through. I mean, you and Nat can have a really good conversation about it. I can see what it may feel like, but I can't naturally feel it. And in the same way as you can't feel or understand how I felt when you close the front door as a dad and you feel this really weird sensation of relief when you're going back to work, almost elation that you're leaving this crying baby, and then immediate guilt that you've left your wife indoors on her own. And that's a weird feeling as well. And so we've all got different paths that we've trodden, but I think being open about it and then empowering people to work together to try and fix it. So you want to create a culture where you can't fix everything immediately, it's impossible, but you want to create a culture where people feel empowered that they can work on the bits that they want to come together to fix. And my vision is that in years to come, we don't need to have, we have, positive discrimination around having, women's leadership programs and, ethnic diversity programs here at McDonald's, because we have to at the moment. My vision in the future is we don't need any of that, because the culture is in such a good place that everyone has a level playing field. Now, that's not the case at the moment, because we don't understand, the journey people have been on. But that's my vision, is that in, 3 or 4 years' time, we won't need to have women's leadership, because it won't be an issue anymore.
Yeah. And I think if anyone's going to get there, it's going to be you and McDonald's. Paul, there's a saying.
Imagine, as you know, Suki, I'll give it a good go.
Yeah, I know you will. I know you will be there cheering you on, helping you all the way, Paul. The saying that says you can't get to courage without walking through vulnerability. Mm. And I think you've shown massive courage. It's amazing and brilliant that you show your own vulnerability. And through that, other people can not just learn, but also be inspired. As always, so inspiring to talk to you today, Paul. Thank you for being so open and honest.
No, my pleasure.
Talk to you again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Suki.
Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed Reset the Podcast, I'd love it if you would forward it to your work colleagues, friends, and family. Reset the Podcast is a Let's Reset and Advertising Week global production. Executive producer is Richard Larson. With me, Suki Thompson. Thanks to our sponsor, Liars Non-Alcoholic Spirits, and voiceover artist, Talitha Penny. Music provided by Audio Network.